I think. But when you look at what you've seen this year, you've seen three quarters of results where the cash flow of the gold stocks has gone up significantly quarter by quarter. There's every reason to think that in the fourth quarter, notwithstanding that big drop we got in the gold price, but there's every reason to think that this quarter, the cash flow will move up again. That is a whole year of four quarters of cash flow increases. The cash flow growth in the gold stocks is the highest of any sector or subsector in the U.S. economy.
It's crazy.
So I've got to think that if we end the year with strong cash flow, more and more investors, let's say, are going to have to notice that. You know, value investors are going to have to say, my gosh, you know, the cash flow is going up, the margins are expanding.
Adrian Day, good afternoon to you. How are you, my friend?
I'm fine, thank you, Andy. Good afternoon to you.
Really good to see you. Really wanted to get your thoughts. We've had some great talks over the year. Want to get your thoughts looking back in the rearview mirror of 2024. Give me your thoughts and impressions of all that's happened from a 30,000-foot view in 24.
Aye. I will try to... I think there's a few main things. Obviously, we've had the election. We can talk about that, what that might mean separately. But obviously, that was a major thing. And, you know, there were a lot of concerns about, possible violence with the country being so divided and so on. And that, thankfully, didn't come to pass. And Trump's winning was so convincing that there really wasn't much room for challenging it. So that was a positive. Stocks, in my view, continue to be overvalued. The U.S. stocks, they continue to be driven primarily by a relatively small group of companies. I mean, some of the Magnificent Seven have stumbled a little bit lately, but it's the market is still being driven by a relatively narrow number of companies. And if you look at, 52-week highs and 52-week lows, it changes, it's varied, but we're still looking right now at about, I think it's about 40% of stocks in the S&P hitting 52-week lows, which, is bad breadth for a market that is charging ahead the way the market is. But on the other hand, there are reasons that people are pouring money into stocks. A lot of it is passive investing through 401ks. And so that is, to some extent, a self-reinforcing mechanism. Gold had a remarkable year. I should have looked. I'm going to look if you'll give me a second. Gold had a very strong year.
Yeah.
And the last 6 months has actually outperformed the S&P. Sorry, my computer's very slow today. The year to date, it's outperforming the S&P. And most people you talk to would not know that. They would not believe that gold had beaten the S&P. But I just checked the numbers as of when we're talking, to make sure that was correct. So gold had a very strong year. But gold stocks, they're doing well. When gold stocks are up, the XAU's up 25% for the year. There's nothing wrong with that. I'll take 25% for 11 months every year, and you give it to me. But there's still obviously a lot of frustration that gold stocks have not exhibited the kind of leverage that we're used to and that we expect from gold stocks over gold, and we can talk about that. So I think those are some of the main themes. And, obviously we're seeing interest rates not just in the US. The Fed had their first cut after a rate hiking cycle in September. But, you know, we see what's happening in Canada, a series of rate cuts, Europe rate cuts, Britain. So we're seeing rate cuts pretty much in every country in the world. Let's leave Japan aside for a second. And that is clearly a major theme of the year, but is going to play out in the year ahead because they are cutting rates before they have controlled inflation. I think it's very clear we saw this with Powell. If you look at Powell's press conferences over the last 12 months, I mean, just biting at the bit to cut rate and just waiting for that opportunity. And the messaging went from a couple of years ago, it was, you know, we're going to get inflation firmly under 2% before we move. And then it was 2%, and then it was on its way to 2%. And then it was, well, if we can see a path to 2%. And so the messaging changed, and the plain fact is the Fed knows, as well as you and I know, that inflation is not controlled. And that's true of other countries as well. But we're cutting rates before we've controlled inflation. And that has serious implications for the year ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to work that a little bit more and then segue into the equities, gold equities. So do you see the Fed is trapped in a box? And why are they cutting if inflation isn't under control? Might be a rhetorical question, but I want you to answer.
No. I mean, there's four major factors that you can look at to say, does the Fed want to cut rates or not? One would be inflation. One would be the economy and particularly employment. One would be that they see systemic risks in the banking system or other financial sectors. And then the fourth one, of course, is the interest on the federal debt. And so I think it's clear to me that inflation, as I say, is not under control. You know, the latest numbers came in, what was it? The CPI was a 2.7 year on year, which sounds awfully low, but 2.7% is still well above the Fed's own target. It's also well above the rate of inflation for many, many years pre-COVID, if you go back before COVID. And that's if we believe the numbers. And everybody I talk to, nobody I talk to says their cost of living only went up 2.7% last year. It's also important, if you look back, let's say the last 5 or 6 months, go back to June, July, and you look at the CPI, or you look at the core CPI, or you look at the PCE, if you just look at those 5 months since we hit the bottom, that does not look like a cost of living. I hate to call it inflation, because that's not what inflation is. Inflation, as you know, the cost of living is a symptom of inflation, the result of inflation. But nobody would look at those last 6 months and say, oh, yeah, inflation is well under control, because the numbers are just inching up. On the economy, I mean, the employment, they grabbed. It seemed to me that Powell grabbed at that little 0.1% increase in the unemployment rate, which, if you believe the unemployment rate, is nothing. But of course, as again, most of us will know, you know, if you look at the unemployment rate as it used to be calculated, and it is still published under something, I think it's U8, correct me if I'm, somebody in the notes comments will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a U8, and that's showing about 8% unemployment rate. Now, this is a bee in my bonnet. You and I have talked about it before, but the labor situation, the employment situation in the U.S. is nowhere near as strong as it appears. You know, you look at the unemployment rate, for example, if you take into account the low labor participation rate, which is the number of people in that 25 to 55 age group who are actually in the job market, that number's gone down. It's gone down consistently over 20 years, but it's gone down over the last 2 years or so. If the labor participation rate is low, your denominator is low. And so, you know, your unemployed number will come out at a lower unemployment rate. But if you counted everyone 25 to 55 who should be looking for a job, even if they're not, that's just one factor. And then, you know, on the jobs reports, we've talked before, they talk about, of course, last month we had a bad one, or 2 months ago, with 12,000 new jobs. But the new jobs created looks reasonably strong. But when you take into account the constant revisions of the Bureau of Labor Statistics does, this year to date, just the monthly, the regular monthly revisions have taken away about 350,000 of the new jobs that were reported. And that's not even counting that one-off, staggering one-off revision that they did for 2023 back in August, when they said, oh, oops, 818,000 jobs that we reported last year, well, they weren't actually created. So, but of course the first numbers get all the publicity, but apart from all of that, even if you look at those numbers, a majority of the new jobs created in the last 12 months, according to the government itself, were either government jobs, mostly local government, by the way, I'm aware of that. Government jobs or part-time jobs. And to me, it is not a strong employment picture when you do not have full-time private sector jobs being created. So anyway, we could go on and on and on. So I don't think those are the reasons that the Fed is cutting rates on the economy. They should be cutting more on inflation. They should be raising rates. I think the main reason, frankly, I don't know of any systemic issues that are imminent. But I think the main reason is just the interest on the federal debt. You know, they have to get the rates down so that the federal government is not spending so much on interest, especially at a time when you have fewer and fewer of the traditional buyers like China, Japan, Russia. Banks, regional banks in the U.S., the Federal Reserve itself, the traditional buyers of long-term treasuries are not in the market. So rates at the long end simply have to move up. That's why Yellen has been issuing so much at the short end, which to me is a bad way to manage a country's debt. You know, you want to lock in relatively low rates for as long as you possibly can. But anyway, so after all of that, Andy, I've forgotten what the question was, but I think I answered it.
Well, you did. It's just really, is the Fed in a box? And
oh, absolutely, they're in a box. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off. But yeah, the Fed is in a box, and they're in a box of their own making, because since Alan Greenspan, and Alan Greenspan is the one that I really blame, because Alan Greenspan knew better. When you go to Bernanke, I don't mean to sound arrogant about this, but he didn't know better. But all the way back to Alan Greenspan, they had monetary policy looser than it should have been, and they put, you know, the Greenspan put, it's now called the Fed put, but it was called Greenspan put, but basically said, we're not going to let the stock market go down. We're going to bail out people who get into trouble. I mean, fancy bailing out long-term capital, a hedge fund, for goodness sake, right, from, I quote, the smartest people in the world. I mean, with all due respect, who cares if it went bankrupt? It should have gone bankrupt, and the investors should have suffered losses. But instead, those losses were socialized, and we all paid for it, and we're still paying for it.
Yeah. No, well said. It seems then, and I hold to your theory that the Fed is in a box, it seems like this is really, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I want your opinion, it's really the perfect environment for precious metals. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, good segue. Well done. No, absolutely. I mean, as we know, gold has gone up over the last 2 years. And for most of that time, it was going up not for economic reasons, macroeconomic reasons, but it was going up primarily because central banks were buying, and central banks were buying for their own reasons, valid reasons. First of all, to diversify out of the dollar is still the majority of foreign reserve asset of central banks around the world. So to diversify away from the dollar, but urged on or aggravated by the weaponization of the dollar that we have seen over the last many, many years, increasingly over the last several years. And of course, the confiscation, illegal confiscation of Russian assets, whatever we think of the war in Ukraine, but the illegal confiscation of Russian assets prompted central banks to think more urgently about the issue. And then we had the Chinese buyers come in at the beginning of this year, and they were buying for their own reasons again. But now that the Fed has cut, along with other central banks, we are now moving to that period when, you know, we're seeing buyers come in for what I would call the normal traditional gold buying reasons. And people are concerned about the high debt levels. And they're concerned about both the national debt levels, but also the annual deficit levels. And people are concerned about stagflation. Lower rates with stubborn inflation and a declining economy or low growth economy with stubborn inflation. And that environment is perfect for gold.
Yeah. Well said. I really think that this is really quite, you know, you don't want to, you want to be humble and careful with everything you say, because it's never exactly how you think it's to be, and oftentimes it's the exact opposite. So all the caveats, you've been doing this longer than me, and I've been doing this a long time. So all the caveats. That being said, it does seem like this is the time for a gold and silver, and it certainly is reflective in the past year.
Sure. Well, and one thing, of course, you mentioned all the caveats. I mean, one big thing is the election is, it does throw a lot of unknowns into the picture. There's no question about that. Now, you can be as skeptical as you want, or you can be as naive as some people are. But whichever end of the spectrum you're on, I mean, there are uncertainties. We just don't know how this is going to play out. We don't know how successful this Doge committee will be in cutting government spending. We could talk about that, but we don't know. At the minimum, even if they're successful, it's going to be 3 or 4 years before we see how successful they've been. Because, you know, even if you lay off government workers, they still get paid for the next year. So yeah. There's no reduction in spending. Even if you laid off half the federal workforce today, you wouldn't save any money for a year. And that's not going to happen, of course. Tariffs, we don't know. We can surmise, but we don't know to what extent, Trump's tariff comments are negotiating posture. To what extent they'll be introduced, how widely they'll be introduced, both which countries will be affected, but also particular goods and services within a country. You know, are they going to be very, very targeted on secured national security products or services from China? That would be one thing. Are they going to be more broadly imposed? That will be another thing. And so there's a lot of uncertainty that we don't know, a lot of things we don't know. And also, of course, there's a perception. So, I mean, gold sold off when Trump was elected. It had already come up a high. We shouldn't forget that. But high was, what, a week, 10 days or something before Trump was elected. But the perception, you know, the Trump's policies are going to be good for economic growth in the U.S. with the cutting of the government spending, but also the easing of regulations, more oil and gas exploration and production. And then other positive things like potentially helping to end the war in Ukraine. Middle East seems to have got more complicated since he was elected, but, you know, and Trump is not afraid, as we know, he's not afraid to go and meet with Kim Il-jong, and, you know, we don't know what he threatened him with, but we do know that after that meeting, there were fewer rockets being fired into the Sea of Japan. You know, we know that. So I think there will, you know, there's a perception that he's going to be positive for the economy, positive for the stock market. And so do we really need gold? But, you know, the market is, you know, U.S. buyers are not buying gold, but other people certainly are. And since he got elected, I mean, yeah. The recovery in the gold price, when did it bottom at the, well, really just middle of November?
Yeah.
That's not been U.S. buyers based on everything I know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is really new. Let me ask you this, in projecting into 25, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that gold stocks were up 25%, I wrote down here, on an average here. That's still significantly lagging, please correct me if I'm wrong, the price of gold. Do you expect in 25 there to be a catch-up then? Yeah, what do you expect with the gold
I'm
stock?
I'm just getting my napkin to polish my crystal ball.
Right.
Yeah, you know, look, again, we did talk about this before, Andy, and I think it's important what people realize. You've got to look at why gold went up for the last 2 years and who was buying and why they were buying. And the people that were buying gold and the reasons they were buying gold was why they bought physical gold. They didn't buy silver, and they certainly didn't buy gold stocks, right? The Bank of China, People's Bank of China, is not going to buy Newmont to stick in their reserves. And the Chinese consumer is not going to buy Newmont to buy and put in their reserves, put in their piggy bank. So the reasons people were buying gold was why gold was going up and the gold stocks were not. Now, it started to shift this year, but as you say, gold stocks are still lagging dramatically over what we would expect at the beginning of a bull market. But in my view, what we saw for the last 2 years was like the hors d'oeuvre, and the main course has only just been served. Well, since I'm an opera fan, it was the overture, and the curtain is just rising. But curtain rose, the main course was served when the Fed cut rates. That, if you go back to all the periods post-Volcker, every time the Fed cut rates for the first time after a rate hiking cycle, gold bottomed and moved up. And the election just simply got in the way of that. So I think we can date this gold bull market from September this year, you know, not, and as I say, the rest was just the overture. Now, you know, the gold stocks still haven't performed dramatically just in the last couple of months, but I think there's reasons for that. One reason, obviously, is the rest of the stock market is doing well, including Bitcoin. And so there's less of an incentive to, you know, look, buy gold stocks. I think that's the main reason. And of course, generalist investors have been bitten by gold stocks a few times in the last decade. And so they're going to be a little more reluctant to come back into the gold stocks, I think. But when you look at what you've seen this year, you've seen three quarters of results where the cash flow of the gold stocks has gone up significantly quarter by quarter. There's every reason to think that in the fourth quarter, notwithstanding that big drop we got in the gold price, but there's every reason to think that this quarter, the cash flow will move up again. That is a whole year or four quarters of cash flow increases. The cash flow growth in the gold stocks is the highest of any sector or subsector in the U.S. economy.
That's crazy.
So I've got to think that if we end the year with strong cash flow, more and more investors, let's say, are going to have to notice that. You know, value investors are going to have to say, my gosh, you know, the cash flow is going up, the margins are expanding. I mean, everybody focuses on the all-in sustaining cost numbers going up. Yes, they've gone up, but look at the margin. I mean, even if you take a high-cost company, you know, 1,400 all-in sustaining costs with gold at 2,700, those are pretty dramatic margins,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
They're almost as good as the newsletter business. Those are pretty dramatic margins. And if the price of oil stays reasonably controlled, the commodity currencies, that's the largest cost input for running a mine. And then the second largest cost input would be the local currency, vis-a-vis the home currency of the miner. So for a U.S. company, what is the cost what is the currency in the countries where they have mines? And if you look at what we call the commodity currencies, Canadian dollar, Australian dollar, Brazilian real, the Brazilian real hits an all-time low 2 weeks ago. These currencies are still very, very cheap. And that's the second largest cost input for operating a mine. For building a mine, it seems like steel. Well, steel is also cheap. So there's room for these costs to move up, frankly, and still have very, very strong margins.
Got it. Well, we talk about margins, I think, of producers. If you can, and we didn't talk about this before the show, can you give me a couple of names of your favorite producers out there so people can just, again, not a recommendation, but they can keep them on their radar to add to potentially?
I'm happy to do that. But the thing I always come back to people when people say, what's your best this or what's your best that or what's your number one this? I always say, what are the criteria that you're giving me? Do you want the lowest risk gold stock that will still participate in a bull market? Or do you want, regardless of risk, I want the one, you know, I'm going to swing for the fences and go for the one that's going to have the highest possible potential. Different things, obviously. Among the major producers, there's no question in my mind that Agnico Eagle, despite the fact that it's moved up, and trades at a premium, is the best major miner out there. And that's why it trades at a premium. That's why it's gone up when Barrick and Newmont have been struggling, because it hasn't been struggling as a company. It still remains, if someone came to me today and said, hey, I just inherited $1 million, I don't own any gold, I would say, well, start with the best, start with Agnico. We can talk about the others, Barrick, the number two producer, arguably has more potential for growth in the next couple of years. It is very undervalued on an asset basis. But of course there's reasons for that, not just the political risk, because the political risk is accounted for in the NAV, right? But also the fact that Barrick has consistently missed their own, their own earnings estimates.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if they missed this quarter as well, frankly. They might not, but they're going to have a pretty darn good quarter to meet their guidance. Among the major, so that's better. So
Let's work our way down to change.
Yeah. Well, let's just, if we may, move next to the big royalties.
Yes.
Of the major, I mean, I love the royalty business. It's a great business.
Yeah. Finally, explain them why you love a royalty business.
Well, as we know, and when we talk about royalties, I'm talking about royalties and streamers. But the royalty business basically is getting exposure to the upside without taking a lot of the risk, and certainly without the ongoing costs and ongoing risks. So a royalty company, they'll put money in, they'll buy a royalty, and the worst that can happen is that the mine doesn't get into production or, you know, in the case of Cobre Panama, for example, is shut down. But they don't have the ongoing costs. So right now, First Quantum is spending millions of dollars a month keeping that mine that was stolen from them, temporarily stolen from them in Panama. But they're spending millions of dollars a month maintaining that mine in a safe condition. Franco, who owns a stream on it, doesn't have to contribute to that. They don't have to pay a penny to that. If First Quantum and Panama come to an agreement on a new regime and First Quantum has to give up even more, remember, they already renegotiated their existing legal contract once, but if they have to give them more, that comes out of First Quantum's pocket, not out of Franco's. So the royalty companies are definitely a lower risk way of getting exposure to the sector, but they also have significant leverage, which people tend to forget about. You know, when a company creates a royalty or stream, not by a legacy one, right? That's a pre-existing one, but when they go to a company and say, hey, you want $300 million, you know, to develop your mine. But company, Franco, Wheaton, Royal, they will always make sure that their royalty or stream covers as much of a surrounding ground as they can possibly get. And so you have a situation where a mine will come into production, it'll produce 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, that company starts doing brownfields exploration around the mine. If they find ore, start trucking it to the mill, well, guess what? Franco Wheaton, they get their royalty on that ore. And how much did they spend for it? Zero.
Right.
That's leverage. I call that leverage. So I think it's a wonderful model. And you only have to look back at how Wheaton and Franco and Royal, how they performed from 2011 to 2016 was a bad time, and they were obviously defensive. But look at how they performed from 2001 to 2011 in an up market. Look at how they performed from 2016 to today. And nobody can tell me that they don't have leverage. Of those, I think my favorite right now to buy would be Franco. Franco is actually a little bit smaller market cap than Wheaton right now, but it's got $1.4 billion in cash on the balance sheet. That's $1 billion with no debt, another $1 billion on a line of credit, incidentally. So they could make a lot of acquisitions. I think
Mabel.
Sorry?
Do you think they will make a lot of acquisitions with that?
They're looking, but they, yeah, I think they will, but like all of them, Franco, Wheaton, they're both, you know, cautious in spending their money.
Sure. The terms,
right. If I may, just a key to Franco, after they had the problem with Cobre Panama, which was their largest stream, so obviously the stock fell, and then they had a couple of problems in their second quarter, Antamina and Antapaccay, two of their largest streams. Both of those mines had problems in the stockpile again. It's now trading. I'm not saying it's a Graham and Dodd value stock. It's not a cigar butt, as Ben Graham liked, but it's trading at its lowest multiple since it went public. So that's all, virtually its lowest multiple since it went public. And the key to me is that they've written off right? Off, 100%. They've written off their investment in Cobre Panama. That means that anything that happens with Cobre Panama from here is upside.
You're kidding. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. They wrote that off last December, actually.
Wow.
A lot of people at the time thought that was a little bit of an aggressive, wasn't necessary. But I guess they did it because of the uncertainty. They just didn't know how long it was going to be.
Yeah.
So any upside from here is, or anything that happens now is all upside. And I think something will happen. It may be, the new government in Panama said they want to get the mine back on. It's very important to the economy. Already you've got Moody's and S&P have downgraded the ratings on the government debt. Fitch actually has Panama government debt as junk. Wow. And Moody's is just the lowest you can be above junk with a negative on negative watch. So, the government there wants to get this back. They're going to have to negotiate with First Quantum. First Quantum's going to have to negotiate with the government. So it'll come back at some point.
Yeah. So what's the downside? What's the downside with royalties? I've been trying to figure that out.
I guess you could say the downside is that the stocks are not cheap. For kicks, I always like to get the exact numbers rather than guess, even though my guesses are normally quite good. Oh, I'm looking at, on Bloomberg, they don't give you ratios for the US. You got to look at Canada. But, you look at, for example, Wheaton trading at 66 times free cash flow, trading a 4x book value. Nobody would say, Ben Graham would not jump up and down. Those sort of multiples. But they've always traded. I think that's the biggest knock on them. I think the second biggest risk would be, and I'm not overly worried about the multiples because they've always traded at high multiples. Excuse me. Because sinus problems. They've always traded at high multiples. And to me, those multiples are justified when they continually grow into, the earnings will grow into them.
Yeah.
The cash flow, I should say. The cash flow grows into it. I think a bigger risk might be, another risk might be, but they will have difficulty employing that cash. And, if you look back at the gold royalty business, it started in 1986, I think, when Seymour Schulich set the field aside. Seymour came from the oil business, as you probably know. He said to Pierre, why don't we have royalty companies in the gold space like we do in the oil space? It's an obvious thing. Why don't we have them? And they created the first royalty company when they bought Goldstrike Royalty from Barrick. And over that time, the market, the business has developed a lot. But it sort of shifted as to where the opportunities were. So, back in the 2013, 14, 15 period, a lot of the big global major base metal companies got into severe financial stress. And so Wheaton and Franco were able to go to Rio and BHP and say, hey, we'll give you $500 million to help with your balance sheet. But in return, we want the byproduct gold from your copper mines. And that was frankly a marriage made in heaven because, BHP and Rio don't really care about gold.
Yeah.
So that was a brand new thing that didn't exist. Now you're seeing companies putting money into the Bella projects, which again is something that didn't happen 5 years ago. They're putting money into developing projects. So the business is shifting all the way along. I think it's going to continue to sort of adapt as to where the opportunities are. But I think there'll always be opportunities. And if at some point Franco says, gosh, we haven't spent a penny for the last decade. I don't think we're ever going to be able to find another opportunity as long as we're around. They can always start paying dividends.
Exactly.
So I'm not worried about that. But that I think would be one reason that people, I think that would be something people would say is of as a risk.
When we met in person, it was in July, and for all my viewers and listeners, you were quite the rock star. A lot of companies there wanted your attention. What gets your attention from a junior that makes you want to write them a check and invest in them? What gets your attention?
Yeah. You mean specifically? Well, first of all, it's always the people. It's always the people number one for me. I mean, we can talk specifics in a second, but the people are always number one.
Good answer.
Because, I think people are very important to businesses anyway. I think the CEO of Nestle makes a big difference to Nestle, and who's CEO of HSBC makes a difference to the direction of the company. We could talk about that if you wanted. But even in the mining business, I mean, look at the difference between Shaw Boyd at Agnico and now Jehudi. Look at the difference in those with Tom Palmer at Newmont and his recent predecessors. Or look at Mark Bristow. No one else, I think it's fair to say, no one else would have succeeded, and I know shareholders are upset, but as a business sense, no one else would have succeeded after that merger between Randgold and Barrick, other than Bristow. You know, Bristow has the energy of a 25-year-old. He flies around, he meets with, you know, he's fixed problems in Papua New Guinea and Pakistan. Remember, Pakistan, the record deck in Pakistan was stolen by the government. They were in international arbitration. In Tanzania, again, the Tanzania mines were closed down by the government. So you look at all the problems around the world that he has fixed by face-to-face negotiations. Look at what they've done to the balance sheet. Gone from a heavily indebted company to now a cash positive company. So anyway, people make a huge difference. But of course, as you get down to the smaller companies, you know, the key players are even more critical to the company. And I will take a good management team with a bad project and no money over a good project and a lot of money and a lousy team. Because a lousy team will spend the money, waste some money, and fritter away a good opportunity. But good people will realize they had a bad project early on. That's one of the key things, not only as a manager of a company, as an exploration company, but frankly, as investors. One of the best things that an investor can do, and I think one of the key attributes of a successful investor, is to be able to say no quickly. You know, what Brett Cook used to talk about, find the fatal flaw. The first thing he does is he looks for the fatal flaw. Why isn't this going to succeed? Charlie Munger, you know, the deceased sidekick of Warren Buffett, as he said, I spend most of my time looking on why I don't like things and trying to dismiss them from my radar as soon as I can. Anyway, people are important. But obviously you, and then the second most important thing would be a company with cash, with, revenue, ideally, or at least with a shareholder base and a circle that means that they can raise capital when they need to. And that to me would be the second most important thing by far.
Any final thoughts for our viewers and listeners? I've taken way too much of your time, but any final thoughts for our viewers here going into the end of the year?
Yeah, well, going into the end of the year, that's a beautiful segue. Thank you for the setup, not a segue. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of taxable selling, particularly among the juniors. I mean, when you look around, junior gold stocks are about the only thing that have losses this year. So we're getting some pretty heavy tax loss selling. I don't even think it's over yet, but we're getting some pretty heavy tax loss selling in the juniors. And you know, the final words will be to take advantage of those great prices. May I mention two?
Please, please.
I mean, one would be Midland, which has been a disappointment. There's no question about that. But as a company, not as a stock, but as a company, Midland has only gone from strength to strength with all the joint ventures they have with Rio and BHP and Macisco and Agnico and Barrick. Strong partners, strong work, good balance sheet. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, it was trading at its 52-week low. So tax loss selling is a good opportunity to get in. And then another one I'll mention, frankly, would be Nucor. You know, Nucor, again, was trading not at its 52-week low, but certainly a lot of people bought at higher prices. And you're seeing that stock under the sort of pressure that a company of that quality doing such work should not be trading. So I think both of those stocks, and there are others as well, will have good rebounds, if not in January, you know, but certainly into the new year.
First quark. Do you have the tickers on both of those real quick?
You know, Midland is ND on Toronto, like a doctor.
Okay.
And Nucor is NCAU on Toronto.
Not perfect. Adrian, my friend, it's always a great time with you. If people want to do business with you, how do they do that? And tell us about your career.
Send me some money. That's easy. No, it's adrianday.com.
Adrianday.com. And you'll manage a gold portfolio of juniors
Our management, thank you for saying that. Our management is actually individualized. So first of all, we're global managers. We're not just gold investors. We're not gold specialists. We're global investors, but our accounts are individualized. So for example, someone can say to me, hey, here's 50% of my portfolio or 50% of my retirement funds. I want it to be generally conservative and global, but, you know, do a little more gold than you normally would for a conservative account. And then they'll add, don't tell my wife.
Sorry.
So yeah, but they're customized. So we have people, I also have people who say, I don't want any gold because I've got gold somewhere else. So people can do, you know, we do have dedicated gold accounts. We have dedicated resource accounts, but most of our accounts are global accounts, which would include gold.
Okay, I will put all of this in the show notes below. And I just, again, want to thank you so much for your time. It's always a fascinating talk, a great talk. And are you going to be at PDAC?
Yes.
Yes. I should be there as well. If I am there,
good.
We'll go to dinners.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. Are you going to VRIC or not in Vancouver?
I'm not going to VRIC, unfortunately, just a scheduling conflict. But I think I can make it. Adrian, I have 5 kids, man.
Although that's the most important thing, you know that.
Yeah, you've got traveling schedules and everything.
No, but you've got to spend the time with the kids because, you know, someone once said to me, nobody on their deathbed ever said, you know, I wish I was spending more Sundays in the office.
Exactly. And I spend way too much time in the office. But like I can make PDAC happen with my schedule. So.
Okay, great. But when they get older, just take them with you. Take them with you to help you.
Yeah. Well, I did that last, I think you met my wife. I did that last July with my wife. Yeah. She had a great time at the spa.
Yes.
All right.
Well, he did.
Thank you so much for sharing your time.
Thank you.